evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, September 28, 2018. President Kiir orders the army to free all political prisoners.
But we're interested to see how the chief of staff will get engaged in releasing political detainees, because it's the prisoners of war, which is directly under chief of staff, and also have the political detainees. We may be taken by other organized forces, but also we hope that the chief of staff will execute the order of the president, because we have seen such orders before.
And South Sudan's first vice president addresses the UN General Assembly.
It is through a change of leaders' attitude from entrenched position that we have moved forward toward a reconciliatory and accommodating government national unity. My president, His Excellency General Salva Kiir Mayardit, has compromised on many positions.
And we will have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. President Salva Kiir issued a decree yesterday ordering the head of the South Sudan Army to release all prisoners of war and political detainees from military facilities. The decree also orders the Chief of Defense Forces to end the training of more recruits to the army. Civil society activists say they will be happy when security agencies implement the order. Winnie Chirino reports for VOA from Juba.
SPLA-IO Deputy Military Spokesperson Colonel Lampo says he welcomes President Kiir's order.
It is a good step from the President to ensure that the prisoners are released. The SPLM-IO also had prisoners of war which have been released sometimes back. The SPLA-IO have almost four high-profile political detainees who have been detained by the government, the likes of Egril Idris, James Gadet, Marco Lokido.
Colonel Paul says the peace agreement, which calls for the release of all prisoners of war and political detainees, does not restrict the release to only those allied to the SPLA-IO, but extends to all illegal detainees. Edmund Nyakani, Executive Director of Community Empowerment for Progress Organization, or CEPO, says civil society activists are impressed that the parties are finally following up the timeline for releasing political prisoners.
Though it come late, but I say it's something that we welcome it. It's a very good one. But we're interested to see how the chief of staff will get engaged in releasing political detainees, because he is in charge. I know there's a two category of people there that need to be released. Is the prisoners of war, which is directly under chief of staff, and also have the political detainees. We may be taken by other organized forces, but also we hope that the chief of staff will execute the order of the president, because we have seen such orders before, and sometimes its implementation is done partially.
Yakani says the release of prisoners of wars and political detainees will speed up the peace process.
So it's not only the government that we ask to do that, but also we ask the other armed groups, if they're holding prisoners of war and political detainees, let them release them. That's a trust and confidence building.
Jame David Kolok, Executive Director for local NGO Foundation for Democracy, Accountability and Governance, says he expects political leaders to be transparent when freeing prisoners of wars and political detainees.
The reason why we're asking for transparency is that up to now, there's been no clear statistics in terms of how many prisoners of war exist within these parties, or how many political detainees are actually in some of these prisons.
Kolok is urging all parties to focus not only on combatants, but also on political detainees.
What we want to see is to ensure that all political detainees under the custody of all these guys, whether a transitional government of national unity or all the parties that are yet to come to Juba, need to be released.
President Kiir's order to free all prisoners of war and detainees is mandated in the revitalized peace agreement signed by the government and opposition groups in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, earlier this month. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
The U.S. ambassador to South Sudan says the Kiir administration has blocked the U.S. government from constructing a new embassy compound despite approving it earlier. The ambassador says South Sudan Foreign Affairs Ministry officials informed the embassy that it must halt the construction until further notice without explanation. A foreign affairs official says the work was stopped for security reasons. For VOA News, Manyang David Mayar reports from Juba.
U.S. Ambassador to South Sudan Thomas Hosek told South Sudan in Focus last week that the project was a sign of the U.S. commitment to South Sudan in building the new embassy.
And we had everything lined up until last month when mysteriously the Ministry of Foreign Affairs told us to halt work on the project. So right now we're trying to work through the details, find out why they don't want us to build a new embassy.
Last week, Foreign Affairs Ministry officials declined requests from VOA to comment in the story. But yesterday, they called a press conference to address the matter. Speaking to reporters, Valentino Bagbag, Foreign Affairs Ministry Undersecretary, said the government decided to halt the project for several reasons.
The land is situated north of our national airport, and the airport is going to be expanding in the very near future. It is also situated immediately south of the military headquarters, the area that we all know as Bill Farm and New Site. For all these reasons, a decision was taken to reallocate or to allocate an alternative land where they will feel secure and safe.
Bach would not say when the government would allocate an alternative piece of land for the U.S. embassy. The U.S. embassy was planning to build its new premises on land allocated to them by the government of former Central Equatorial State beginning next month. Ambassador Hosek says by halting the construction, the Foreign Affairs Ministry is delaying many economic benefits to Juba City that would have been derived from the new construction.
It would have been one of the biggest construction programs going. It would have been great for the local businesses, great for the overall urban development. We can't issue all the visas here because we don't have the security infrastructure to accommodate that process. So that will come with a new embassy or not if they don't let us build it.
Hosek says the current embassy compound used to be a consulate for the U.S. embassy in Khartoum when South Sudan was still part of Sudan. He says it does not meet the standards of the U.S. embassies, even those in the neighboring countries like Uganda and Kenya. U.S.-South Sudan relations have soared in recent years, especially after the U.S. pushed for an arms embargo against Juba and imposed sanctions on government and opposition officials accused of obstructing the peace process. Despite all that, Hosek says the U.S. has demonstrated its commitment to supporting the people of South Sudan.
Just the last 2 years, we've invested hundreds of millions of dollars, more than a billion, in helping in just the humanitarian side, helping the people of South Sudan. Some of them are in refugee camps across the border, but most of them are here. So we are already investing heavily in this country, much more heavily than any other donor, and importantly, more than even the government is able to invest right now.
While the United States struggles to build its new embassy compound in Juba, China, which has large oil investment in South Sudan, is already building a permanent embassy in Juba. For VOA News, Amanyang David Mayer in Juba.
Still on U.S.-South Sudan relations, a State Department official told South Sudan in Focus the United States remains committed to saving lives of South Sudanese people. The official says the U.S. looks for South Sudan's leaders to demonstrate a sustained commitment to peace, inclusivity, financial accountability, and good governance. In order to be convinced of the party's commitment, the official said, quote, "We will need to see a change of approach, which includes, but is not limited to, an end to violence, full humanitarian access, the release of all political prisoners, including those held by the National Security Service, and a real commitment to accountability and implementation." End of quote. The official went on to say that today should be demonstrated by supporting robust security and enforcement mechanism and checks on executive and majority power. South Sudan's first vice president, Taban Deng-Gai's speech to the UN General Assembly a few hours ago featured a list of reported accomplishments by the Kiir administration and detailed the path the government took in signing the long-awaited revitalized peace deal. SIN Deng Bio reports from UN headquarters in New York. The delegation's effort to garner financial and political support could be derailed by recent reports of continued fighting in South Sudan.
At the UN General Assembly, South Sudan's delegation said they are on a campaign to change the image of the government and convince Western donors they are, quote, serious this time about implementing the peace agreement. Taban Dengai told the UN General Assembly there has been real change in his country.
Last year, I stood before you as the first vice president of a country amid violent conflict. Today, I stand before you as a testament of what members of this body have helped achieve in the Republic of South Sudan.
Deng's speech was written to highlight some of the compromises Kiir made to sign the agreement.
It is through a change of leaders' attitude from entrenched position that we have moved forward towards a reconciliatory and accommodating government national unity. My president, His Excellency General Salva Kiir Mayardit, has compromised on many positions and worked with more stakeholders for the sake of peace.
Deng's speech comes at a time when reports of atrocities and renewed fighting in central Equatoria and former Unity State have surfaced. Jean-Pierre Lacroix, the United Nations Undersecretary General for Peacekeeping Operations, told the Security Council last week that within days of signing the revitalized deal earlier this month, credible reports of fighting in central Equatoria and Unity State emerged, with heavy clashes in Jamula Center and Mbudu in Kajokeji on September 13th. Lacroix said small-scale clashes occurred between Taban Dengai-aligned forces and the SPLM-IO in and around Nying in Unity State's Guit County. Deng's speech did not mention those reports. The relationship between the United Nations and South Sudan has hardened in recent months, with Information Minister Michael McQuay accusing the U.S. and U.N. of wanting a regime change. But today, the South Sudanese vice president had a different message to the United Nations.
I would like to reiterate that my government welcomes the presence and support of the United Nations agencies. However, the term of this relationship needs to be reconsidered, specifically in protecting the vulnerable citizens in the host country. It is only through a reflective approach that we can move forward towards adopting the nature of this institution to make it fit for the environment today.
Taban Dengai is expected to travel to Washington, D.C. over the weekend and then to Canada next week, where he is planning to meet with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Ayan Dengbior, VOA News, United Nations.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the UN warns of famine in South Sudan. Find out more when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today.
How much do you love your own country?
I love my country so much because Malawi has a good reputation wherever Malawi is mentioned. And so I love it so much and I wanted to show a progress in everything that we are doing right now.
I can say there's no percentage, but I love my country. I'm patriotic and I just love it all, like wholeheartedly. There's no percentage I can rate it with. My country, South Sudan, of course, is blessed, and I love it generally.
Not 100%, but I love it a lot in that if there are some things concerning my country, which shows patriotism, like voting, like participating in other political stuff, I engage myself in such.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. A joint report by the World Food Programme, the UN Children's Fund, and the Food and Agriculture Organization finds that more than 6 million people in South Sudan, or well over half of the country's population, face extreme hunger due to continued conflict and insecurity. ONN Walter Solomon has more for VOA from Juba.
The head of South Sudan's National Bureau of Statistics, Isaiah Chola Rue, says 6.7 million people of the 10.9 projected population faced food crisis or acute food insecurity at the peak of the lean season. Chola says although food security has slightly improved with September's harvest relative to July and August, 47,000 people have experienced famine in South Sudan, while 1.7 million others are in need of emergency food assistance, according to the latest Integrated Food Security Phase Classification Report, or IPC.
However, an anticipated earlier than normal start of the lean season will result in an estimated 5.2 million, which is 49% of the total population, people will be in crisis IPC phase 3, or worse, between January and March 2019, with 36,000 in catastrophe IPC phase 5.
UN Children's Agency says that the nutrition situation remains critical in many areas affected by severe food insecurity, with a million children under the age of 5 severely malnourished. Miahinbo Mdoe is the UNICEF representative in South Sudan.
UNICEF projects about 1.1 million children to be acutely malnourished this year, out of which about 300,000 will be severely acutely malnourished and at risk of dying. So, what more can be done to ensure the situation improves and that many more children fall asleep each night, free of hunger pains, and content that they will wake up with energy ready for a new day?
Food insecurity has increased in counties of the Greater Upper Nile, Barrel Gazala, and Greater Lakes regions, which Chol attributes to poor access to health and nutrition services, high mobility, extremely poor diets, and poor sanitation.
In September 2018, it is expected that small percentage of the population are in catastrophe phase 5 in Leer and Mayendi, Yerul East and Yerul West, Canal and Fiji, Banyikang and Greater Bagari in Wau. In October-December 2018, catastrophe IPC 5 outcomes are expected in Leer and Mayendi, Fibor, Banyikang, and Greater Bagari in Wau. In January-March 2019, catastrophe is expected in Fibor and Canal, Fiji, and Leer and Mayendi.
And the report warns that more than 35,000 people will be experiencing famine in the first quarter of 2019, especially in Jonglei State. Chol says humanitarian food assistance and ongoing nutrition services by aid agencies have prevented more catastrophic outcomes.
It is highly recommended that the humanitarian food assistance be scaled up to meet the estimated need, and that the rebuilding of livelihoods and improving access to basic services also be pursued. However, large-scale humanitarian assistance is still critical to avert a deteriorating situation, especially in areas with continued access constraints.
World Food Program is asking donors to help them deliver food to the most vulnerable populations. Simon Kamelberg is the World Food Program Acting Country Director in South Sudan. UN agencies and NGOs are calling on the parties who recently signed peace deals to allow aid agencies unfettered access to people in need so interventions can be implemented to prevent further deterioration of food security across the country. For VOA News, I am Onan Walter Solomon in Juba.
Still on humanitarian issues, a young South Sudanese humanitarian is at the UN General Assembly in New York to push an agenda for inclusion of women and accountability for perpetrators of crimes committed in South Sudan. Angelina Nyajima Simon is the executive director of the non-profit Hope Restoration South Sudan, which operates primarily in hard-hit Leer and Mayendit counties. Famine was briefly declared in both counties last year. Simon tells Ayen Deng Bior she's in New York to convince people to support South Sudan.
For the few meetings that I've been addressing talking about the women issues, the national organization issues, they're really getting it well, they're getting it loud and clear, because very few occasions South Sudanese get opportunity to really speak up their voices in these high-level events. So we feel the world leaders and other communities are understanding that, yes, South Sudanese are tired. That's why they are talking about their suffering. Women of South Sudan are also really, this business of suffering is extreme and something has to be done. And South Sudan is not an isolated area. It's not an isolated country. It's part of the world. And the suffering of South Sudan, if there's no peace in South Sudan, surely there's also no peace in the neighboring countries. And if there's no peace in the neighboring countries, it might spread all over.
You're here to lobby on behalf of women, and you're promoting inclusion of women in the peace process. Why do you think some women hesitate to take part of building their own country?
Oh, I can't say women are stating in taking part in building their own country in South Sudan, but I just feel from the onset of my discussion that there are very few support to women. And that might be one issue, that women are also not frequently outspoken about the issues that they are going through. But then if they have an opportunity, they'll always, whatever is happening, no woman is happy about it, because at the end of the day, those who are being killed, they're your husband, they're your children, they're your brothers. So nobody's proud of whatever is happening in the country.
The work that you do, could you describe it for me? Is it hard? Is it easy? Is it strenuous? How would you describe your work?
My work, I can say it is quite difficult work. One, the area where we operate, it has been all on the spotlight for years, since 2013 up to today.
And where do you operate?
We operate in Unity State and particularly in Leer and Mayandit. These are areas that for the entire crisis in South Sudan, they have never enjoyed any relative peace. The issues of the rape cases that has been all over on the spotlight, almost 80% of those rape issues happen in that southern Unity State. The issue of farming that has always been declared, the IPC challenges has always been in southern Unity. The issues of lack of health facility has always been in that location. The issues of school of children not going to school since the crisis up to today is also in that area.
Not to mention the famine declared last year.
Yeah, if I talk about the famine declared last year, since the conflict, it's not possible for farmers to go and do their farming. It's not possible for any business person to go on their usual business to do business. So we are all rendered helpless to be waiting for WFP food drops to be taken to those locations. And once there's a conflict, it's always very difficult to get assistance, because if you try to drop food in this location, there will be attack in the other location. So it always become extremely difficult, and malnourished is quite high.
How do you maintain enthusiasm? I mean, you work in one of the hardest hit areas in South Sudan. Where do you find the hope to continue your work?
With the little I do, with the little my other colleagues are doing, we'll always create change in the country, the peace that we want, because home is always the best, no matter what, how bad it is. That's why I never have energy to get out. And the little we do to a woman outside there, they appreciate it. That alone creates happiness in me. That alone energizes me to do more.
That's Angelina Nyajima Simon, Executive Director of Hope Restoration South Sudan. She was speaking to Ayen Bior from New York. The latest Ebola outbreak in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo has been particularly dangerous because the area is an active conflict zone with more than 100 armed groups. The World Health Organization is worried that ongoing violence could allow the two-month-old outbreak to spread. There was initial success as vaccine and new treatment drugs were put to work. Then came a series of worsening attacks near the epicenter, the city of Beni. Officials say civilians were targeted in an incursion last Saturday. Aid agencies told their workers to stay inside as a period of mourning was punctuated by angry protests over the violence. In addition, some people are refusing treatment due to lack of knowledge about Ebola, and conspiracy theories are spreading that government is behind the outbreak in the opposition area. Tariq Jasevich of WHO spoke with my colleague Paul Alexander about the situation.
This was always a scenario that we were fearing, that insecurity will hamper the effort significantly. The security situation has worsened in recent weeks and days, culminating in this attack that happened a few days ago, leaving 21 persons dead in Beni, and Beni is the base for our operations. And obviously, we have to take care of security of our own staff. If we cannot reach people who are infected with Ebola, these people will not go to treatment centers and will not receive appropriate care that will increase their chances of survival. They will potentially infect their loved ones, those who care for them, that's family or local health workers. And we cannot provide protection through vaccination to those who are most at risk.
It would seem that the armed groups would recognize that there are benefits to having you guys around.
Well, there are a number of armed groups active in the area. WHO really has no military expertise to assess really all these groups and military movement. We do not have direct contact with armed formations, but we work with our partners in the UN mission and with the authorities, and we really try to spread the message that Ebola will affect everyone, no matter what the political affiliation.
It's hard for most people to comprehend how someone would actually run away from treatment. Is this being fueled locally?
First time this particular province is facing Ebola, so we had to go through some general education program through mass media and through reaching out to communities. And we think that the knowledge about disease has increased. However, there is, in certain parts of population, mistrust. And this is obviously fueled by insecurity, fueled by really decades of the conflict. And then it can be also exploited by different groups who may present and fuel this misinformation and fuel the mistrust by the population for their own interests. In a small number of cases, we have to really recognize that overall acceptance was good, but in certain instances, people would eventually flee from the responders, would hide their loved ones who were sick, and if someone who is infected goes 100 kilometers away without us knowing it, this exactly results in what we are seeing, that we see cases popping up further away. And that complicates the response significantly, because then we have to go there and put in place again all those measures that are needed. It is worrying that we see cases appearing further away from the epicenter.
Now, there's been resistance to vaccination and treatment, including violent resistance.
What we have seen is when responders would come to a community when there was a sick person, that a community would not allow.
That's Tarek Jesevic of WHO speaking with my colleague Paul Alexander about the situation in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. And that brings us to the end of our show for this Friday. We leave you with the song Yangada Gadia by Emmanuel Emi Yore.
Voilà. Passa com da coro, como pingo com a coro te, como fura e pico, unicato na quina guapa engamina waka wakareme, mulher bile minimale com a gereio, e ne kitio ara gafare, e fora kacha mama, mina sana e do mundo kacha lala.
We have been listening to a test of that music by M.E.J. Yore. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Have a peaceful weekend and join us next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.